Thought Leadership from PwC's National Office.
So when you think about a description of the business, risk factors, legal proceedings, management's discussion and analysis, all of those, depending on how the operations of the company are impacted, could require disclosure today. And that's not changing. And so I think companies need to make sure that they're thinking about that. Even if the new rules become effective, that doesn't replace those existing requirements too.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. It's been almost 2 months since the SEC approved the final climate disclosure rules on March 6, 2024. And since that time, on April 4, 2024, we saw the SEC stay the rules to, quote, facilitate the orderly judicial resolution, end quote, of pending legal challenges. That said, we think it's important to understand the new rules, including their place in the broader reporting landscape. We know many companies are preparing for mandatory reporting in the EU and/or California and believe it's helpful to keep the SEC requirements in mind as you prepare. Joining me to discuss some of the nuances of the SEC rules are PwC National Office partners Diana Stoltzfus, Kevin Vaughn, and Valerie Wieman, who've all spent a lot of time digging into the rules and having discussions with clients and engagement teams. So let's get started. Kevin, Diana, Val, so nice to have you back to talk about the SEC climate disclosure rules. And I think one of the things that we'll start with is a question that's on top of everyone's mind, which is that given that these rules have been stayed and given the fact that most companies are busily preparing for both the EU rules, the CSRD, the California rules, both GHGs, TCFD, carbon offsets, and otherwise, and then we're seeing a lot of other countries adopting the ISSB standards. Given this much, much broader reporting landscape, why focus on the SEC rules? So Val, I'll start with you. Just talk a little bit about the stay and then how this fits into this broader landscape.
Yeah. So from a stay perspective, on April 4th, the SEC voluntarily stayed their own rule. And that's not unprecedented. They've done that one before. But we see that really as a preemptive move on the part of the SEC, where they wanted the court to really focus on the merits of the case instead of getting bogged down in some other petitions for the stay. So they've done that. But I think the fact that it stayed, it's uncertain what's going to happen. And I think that's the biggest point that we need to focus on, is that it could take more than a year for it to be resolved. And resolution in the court that it's currently in, the circuit court, could be appealed by either party to the Supreme Court. So you're looking at a full year. But in the meantime, there's no guarantee that when the stay is lifted or when there's a final resolution, that there'll be an impact on the effective dates. So there's a combination of how we think companies should look at this holistically overall, as you mentioned, that sort of the new alphabet soup, so much that we've actually stopped counting. We used to have a tracker of how many acronyms we mentioned on a podcast. But I think that it's in the context of the overall requirements and the overall ESG landscape, it's just another set of requirements you need to consider as you're developing your systems and your processes and your controls. And if you have that sort of network and processes in place to develop really good quality data from an investor grade data, I think that will serve you well for being able to slice and dice that data for whatever current or emerging framework comes out, and will also place you well for when the stay is lifted if there's no impact on the effective date.
Well, I think the last point is a great one, and I think important. I actually been meeting this week with our the team responsible for writing the GHG chapter of our sustainability reporting guide, which that chapter will be coming out in the next month or so. And one of the things we were talking about is data, because GHG is one of the places where, under these different frameworks, potentially you could wind up where your emissions are actually reported with different numbers, which is a little mind-boggling, and we will not get into that further. But I do think this focus on data, and to your point, understanding these SEC rules, because the last thing you want to do is prepare, let's say, for CSRD, kind of ignore SEC saying, well, it's stayed right now, and then the stay is lifted, you have to adopt, and now you have to actually go back and rework some of the processes you've put in place. So hence why we're still going to cover the rules on the podcast, on our webcasts, et cetera. And I think for today's podcast, just for our regular listeners, this is going to dive a little deeper into some of the areas of questions. But the other thing I wanted to give as a reminder at the beginning of the podcast is that these are not the only SEC climate rules, and the existing rules are not stayed. So maybe, Diana, I can bring you in just so we can, again, level set for the audience. You can't ignore what happened before.
I think that's a great point, Heather. I think the SEC's 2010 interpretive release, the commission's guidance related disclosures related to climate change, is still applicable. So companies need to be thinking about that. I think when you read the release, it talks about regulatory developments, legislative developments, physical risks related to climate change, and talks about how those impacts to a company, depending on the company's facts and circumstances, could require disclosure under the SEC's current requirements. So when you think about a description of the business, risk factors, legal proceedings, management's discussion and analysis, all of those, depending on how the operations of the company are impacted, could require disclosure today. And that's not changing. And so I think companies need to make sure that they're thinking about that. Even if the new rules become effective, that doesn't replace those existing requirements too. So I think companies need to think holistically about their business, their operations, what risks they face, and how they're impacted by climate-related events.
All right. Well, this is a helpful reminder. And in particular, again, regular listeners will know that this has been a topic of SEC comment. And I think we would expect to continue to see that, especially given with the stay in place. And Diana's nodding at me for the benefit of the listeners. So agreeing.
Yes,
that,
agree.
I mean, that we do think the staff will continue to focus on this in the meantime.
So. Right. I think that's a great point, too, is that companies can look to, you know, the Dear Issuer letter, too, to think about what are the types of questions that the staff is focused on and what they're thinking about.
Oh, great reminder. And we can put a link to that in the show notes. So as I said, let's dive into the rule. We are going to try to focus today on some areas where questions have been coming up. But Kevin, maybe before we do hit some new topics, it is probably helpful to remind people of at least the scope of what companies are impacted by the rule. And then we'll dive a little deeper. So can you just, again, remind us of the scope?
Yeah, absolutely. So the rules apply for domestic and foreign private issuers. So basically all registrants, except for our Canadian friends, the multi-jurisdictional disclosure system, 40F filers, as they're often known, MJDS. So the rules do not apply to them. There's an exception for those filers. Everybody else, it applies to you. It applies. One question we get a lot, what about debt only registrants? It applies there. IPOs, it applies for those as well. And then the requirements are basically new disclosures in the 10K or 20F. And so the annual reports, as well as disclosures and registration statements. And so that's the focus of where all this information will be contained, is in those filings. There's not anything specific for quarterly reports. So 10Qs don't, there's no additional disclosures in the 10Qs, but Diana, there's points that you were just making about thinking about, are there updates to information that you had in the annual report? Are there updates to risk, things like that? I think that is still relevant for thinking about in a Q, but there's no direct requirements here. And the rules also apply to all different types of filers, except for the GHG rules, which we'll talk about a little bit, but large accelerated filers and accelerated filers that are not smaller reporting companies or emerging growth companies. That's a mouthful.
Yes.
Those are the only entities that have to do GHG emissions disclosures.
All right, that's helpful. So I'm going to test your knowledge here. That's not exactly on point to the SEC rule. However, this is a question I keep getting, is why the special treatment for Canadian registrants?
You are testing my knowledge here. It's basically a system that was set up, I think, to encourage many years ago, to encourage Canadian filers to file in the U.S. as well, and to kind of open up the borders, if you will. And I think there's also the Canadian filers, they follow their own regulations for those disclosures. And so they already have in Canada, I'm not an expert on Canadian sustainability reporting, but my understanding is they already have reporting there that allows them to.
That's pretty extensive already before companies start thinking they're going to move to Canada.
Yeah. Well, also, and they're looking at new rules. Our Canadian colleagues would remind us. But I do think it's an important point because I have been getting this question from a lot of foreign private issuers. Like, why is Canada so special? And I mean, they are our neighbors. I think the two securities regulators have worked together in the past. And so anyway, that's that question. So then let me move into some more overarching questions as well that we have. Again, these are questions that we are receiving. And specifically, I'm sure our audit colleagues will appreciate this question about whether or not these disclosures are subject to any type of certifications from management, internal control over financial reporting, or otherwise. And Dana, I'll go to you for that.
Great. Yeah. I think that's a great point. The new climate-related disclosures will be subject to a company's disclosure controls and procedures, which includes the principal executive and financial officer certifications. This is similar to any other information that's contained in a filing today. I think similar when we think about the financial statement disclosures, those will be subject to a company's internal controls over financial reporting, including management's assessment of the effectiveness of those internal controls over financial reporting. And then also, if applicable, the independent auditor's assessment or attestation report.
All right. So that's helpful, I think, just as sort of the backdrop of who's in scope and how, from a company point of view, you should be thinking about things, the types of processes and controls you should put in place. So let's jump then into some of the questions that we've been getting. And in particular, I think there's a lot of questions and even confusion, I will use that word, about scenario analysis, when it's required, when it would be disclosed in the SEC disclosures, and in particular for companies that may be doing scenario analysis and, you know, disclosing it under one of the other frameworks. But first, let's talk about when it's disclosed under SEC, and then I'll ask you about some specific other frameworks.
So from an SEC perspective, it's one of the areas that technically you don't need to disclose it if you're not using it. So here you look at if you're using scenario analysis, and if that scenario analysis identifies a material climate-related risk, then you would be subject to those disclosures.
And then if you are, let's start with California, since we're in the U.S. So now you're disclosing under TCFD. What is required under TCFD, and how would that interact with the SEC rules?
So from a TCFD perspective, the scenario analysis is basically required. So you're required to look at a scenario of 1.5 degrees global warming. So that's actually a requirement, as opposed to if that is not actually a material climate related risk. So if you're using it for the TCFD because it's a requirement, but the use of scenario analysis does not identify a material climate related risk, then you would not be required to disclose that for SEC purposes.
And the point being that for TCFD, there is no materiality threshold related to those disclosures.
Correct.
All right, that's very helpful. And then I think the other place that we get this question is under ESRS, which is the reporting for the EU. What would happen, again, specifically related to climate, if you are disclosing scenario analysis there?
So there's probably more alignment between the disclosures. So if you're under the ESRS, you are basically using scenario analysis if you've already identified climate as a material risk. So it's highly likely that any of the scenario analysis they use for that purposes would probably meet the requirement for the SEC disclosure.
And I think for all our listeners that are like waving their hands and saying, all right, well, there's a difference, though, because your materiality under ESRS is double materiality, so impacts, risks, and opportunities. And here in the U.S. for the SEC, you're only under financial materiality. Nevertheless, we think
likely
it's in most
right.
cases,
yeah.
It would be likely that you would, if you're using it, that there it is because there's material climate-related.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
All right, that's helpful. And I guess, again, sort of an impromptu question. Maybe I'll go to Diana with this one. We are getting a lot of questions about the differences here in materiality between how you think about financial materiality under SEC and financial materiality under the other frameworks, double materiality. So not to get deeply into it, because I think it's worthy of a whole podcast probably, but any just immediate reactions if you're a registrant trying to grapple with materiality in the context of your SEC filing when it relates to these climate matters.
Yeah, and I think there is probably some existing, you know, precedent that's out there to help people think about that. I've been thinking about this question a lot, Heather, and I know, you know, the release talks a lot about the reasonable investor and altering the total mix of information. But I think, you know, areas such as like management's discussion and analysis, risk factors, I think some of those other areas that we've talked about where registrants are having to think about materiality today and what requires disclosure today, and not that it's necessarily the same, but I think those concepts are resonating. So I think going back and reading some of the releases related to MD&A, especially there was an update in 2020, and there's discussion around the reasonably likely threshold, which is also within the disclosures in SK related to climate. I think kind of refreshing on some of those concepts can be helpful when you're thinking about materiality.
All right. Very helpful. And again, for our listeners' benefit, this is a topic we are spending time talking about. Diana is actually working with the group that is working on that chapter of our guide. And so more to come on the topic of materiality. But maybe for now, let's turn to targets and goals, another area where we get a lot of questions. And specifically, Kevin, where we're getting questions is the interaction with the GHG disclosures. You mentioned this very briefly before, that it is only the large accelerated and accelerated filers that are required to disclose GHG emissions, and they are only required to disclose scope 1 and scope 2, and there's some phase in and otherwise of timing. But there could be a lot of other filers that have targets or goals related to GHG, or you could have those filers that have scope 3 targets. So how does that all sort of fit together?
Yeah, this has definitely been an interesting topic and getting a lot of attention. The targets and goals is not tied to any specific GHG disclosures in the filing. So the disclosures that would be triggered there, it's not tied to whether or not they are GHG related. It's broader than that. And then this question of it's kind of gotten the phrase backdoor scope 3. Is this targets and goals disclosures basically a backdoor way that the SEC got scope 3 emissions information into the filing? And I think my personal thought is no, it's not directly that. Certainly you could have targets and goals related to scope 3 emissions, and that would certainly qualify for disclosure here if it was material, but it doesn't require you to disclose the specific emissions in that scenario. So you would have to disclose information about the targets and goals and your progress in meeting those targets and goals. And that's an annual kind of update. Like, what have you done this year, to progress on that target or goal? But it doesn't necessarily specifically require the specific emissions. And this was even the Division of Corporation Finance at the SEC, their director recently made remarks at a conference addressing this exact question that saying that it's not meant to be backdoor scope 3 disclosure requirement, that's not what they were looking for in that. But that absolutely can come up, and companies will have to think about that broadly, even if they're already disclosing scope 1, scope 2, think about scope 3. And for companies that don't have to disclose scope 1, scope 2, still think about whether they have targets or goals that will require disclosure of the progress being made.
So to your point about progress, and just push back like a small bit, it seems like if I'm a registrant and I do have, let's say, scope 3, just for ease here, goal, then what are some of the other ways that you would show progress other than showing that, look, my scope 3 is coming down?
Yeah, I think you would potentially describe it in percentages versus the whole numbers of emissions. So if you have a reduction target of 50%, and for a specific category, you could say we're halfway there, whatever the case may be. But I think it would be more probably more of a qualitative type of discussion on the progress versus specifically saying our starting point was X amount of emissions and now we're at Y. It'll just be more, I think, a broader disclosure.
And I guess talking then also about the actions you're taking and how you're approaching and some of those disclosures will be important in that context as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, it's important to remember there also, Heather, is from a timing standpoint, the disclosures for emissions, there's that provision that allows you to report those not within your 10K, but as late as the due date for your second fiscal quarter. There's no such delay for the disclosures about your targets. So when you have these disclosures that relate to emissions, those actually have to be included in your 10K.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And again, also, I think the point about the fact that you are not required to disclose even scope one and scope two for registrants and scope of those disclosures, lots of the word scope, that also, you know, there's another gap there. So definitely some gaps and something for companies to think about if they have these goals. I guess the other question that does come up related to targets and goals that Kevin, maybe I'll start with you again, is what does it really mean to have a target or goal? Because that is like, it can anyone set the target or goal? Yeah. Does it have to be approved by the board? Like where is that line drawn?
Yeah, no, that's a question that we've heard as well. And I just remind, it is a materiality based. So there's no set framework for what would qualify as a target or goal. So it could be, it could be a subsidiary of the registrant has a target or goal, and you would evaluate that. But it doesn't have to go to CEO approval or board approval or anything like that. That level of formality isn't required. But I do think some of those things would factor into your evaluation of materiality. You know, if something is being reported up to the board, I'm not going to say that that's automatically material, but certainly would be a pretty strong indicator. Or if something isn't being reported up to the C-suite, it's just being managed at a lower level, maybe that's an indicator that it may not be material. So I think those factors definitely play in there.
So the other question we get is whether it actually has to be announced publicly. I don't know why you would have a material target that you would not announce publicly, but just because it's not announced actually doesn't change the rules. So even though it's an internal target, that would still be subject to disclosure.
All right. That's definitely helpful. So Kevin, let me go back to you for another sort of interaction question. And this is, I'll say, on the periphery of GHG, because it's talking about RECs and offsets, so the renewable energy credits and then carbon offsets. And in this case, there are disclosures that are in the financial statements, but then there are also disclosures, you know, that could appear in other parts of the 10K. So do those automatically result in disclosure of the same information?
Yeah. So the starting point is the same. So the trigger for the disclosure, both for the financial statement and outside the financial statements, is if the renewable energy credits or offsets have been used as a material component of the plan to achieve the targets or goals, then that's when you would trigger the disclosure. But then that's where it diverges. It's different information. So when you think about the disclosures outside the financials, it's more about what's the underlying quality of the offsets and RECs? How were they generated? What's the location of the underlying projects? Things like that. So to me, that's about, again, it's about providing info on the quality of what's being used, and really, like, is that strategy sustainable? Is that going to impact the business, right? If you're only meeting your targets and goals because you're purchasing offsets and RECs, right, then is the cost going to go up over time? Is the availability going to be there versus if it's a decreasing portion of how you're meeting your targets and goals, maybe that's going to be a different evaluation for investors. And then the financial statement disclosures, it's really about what is the impact in the financial statements. So those disclosures are, you know, we joke about it. It's basically a roll forward of your balances. It does not require it to be in a roll forward format, but that's the information. What were the additions and subtractions to those balances during the course of the year? And how did they impact the financials, as well as what are some of the accounting policies around that?
Well, yeah, and if it's basically a roll forward, it seems like presenting it as a roll forward may be the most helpful, but I guess we could see about that. And then, Kevin, I think you mentioned this, but just to reiterate the point, one of the big areas of focus, just more broadly about the use of offsets and RECs, is just the quality of the offsets and, you know, making sure you're disclosing like the types of instruments you're using. So that your investors have an idea of, again, the quality of those instruments.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So then let's turn actually to the financial statements, which is very unique compared to some of the other frameworks, because we don't see that in any of the others where there's a mandatory disclosure in the financial statements. So Diana, just maybe quick overview of what's required, but probably more so I'm interested in what types of questions are you getting?
Sure. And I'll just start quickly. I really think about it in three different components, and they're very focused on what is the impact on the financial statement. So the first one is the financial effects of severe weather events and other natural conditions on the financial statements during the relevant fiscal year. The second is the impact of carbon offsets and renewable energy credits, which Kevin just went through.
Yeah.
And then the last piece is related to estimates and assumptions and how those have been materially impacted by either severe weather events and other natural conditions or a company's transition plans and targets if those have been disclosed.
All right. And then in terms, I can guess the questions, but what are probably your top couple questions that you're getting?
Sure. I think one is really around these thresholds. You know, there was this 1%. There was a lot of feedback from the proposal. It's changed a little bit, but it stayed in the final rule. So the 1% of pre-tax income, 1% of stockholders' equity, that these aggregate costs are measured against. You know, there are some de minimis thresholds, but I think we've gotten a lot of questions around how that interacts with kind of your traditional financial statement concepts of materiality. And the answer is there really isn't an interaction. These are bright lines. So if a company calculates it and they meet these thresholds, disclosure is required. I think the next piece kind of going to that too is this relevant fiscal year concept, and that the thresholds are based off of your pre-tax income and loss and your stockholders' equity as of the end of the relevant fiscal year. So companies aren't going to know whether or not they've triggered this or be able to calculate this threshold until probably after year end. And also these events could occur throughout the year, so a company will be aggregating the cost. So I think a lot of this disclosure and determination around it is really going to be something that's happening after year end, which is interesting point that companies will need to think about as they're thinking about what processes and controls that they need to have in place.
Yeah, and I guess this is a key point if I go all the way back to the beginning to some of what Val and I were talking about in terms of you can't really just hope these rules go away, because you really are going to need to have some good processes and systems in place to make sure you're capturing this information, because no one wants to be scrambling after year end to come up with a disclosure, particularly if you don't even have a way to track this information.
Right. And I think that goes back to one of our earlier points too, around making sure that the companies have, you know, their DCNP in place and internal control. These are internal controls over financial reporting, right, as well as your audit requirements. So there will need to be, you know, detailed controls around this and how you're identifying this information.
All right. So then let me ask another follow-up question, because one of the things you mentioned there is that you're looking at both the impact in the balance sheet and the income statement. And obviously, you know, double entry accounting, we would expect impacts of different things to show up in two different places. So for example, if PP&E is destroyed, then you're going to see a write-off in the income statement. You're going to see a change in the balance sheet. So how do you, is there ordering, or how do you decide which one comes first, or how do you decide the disclosure there?
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point, is that you will have balance. So in your example where you're writing off, you're going to have that, you're going to see that in the balance sheet and the income statement. And that will be measured each against those individual thresholds. So you'll calculate your 1% of your pre-tax income, 1% of your stockholders' equity, and it could trigger on either both of them, one of them, or neither of them. So I think, you know, if it triggered on one side, if a company felt it was helpful to provide additional disclosure, they're not precluded from doing that. But it is an interesting scenario where you could have the disclosure just triggered on either the balance sheet or the income statement side.
Yeah. And then I guess the sort of follow-up to that is that in some of those cases, then you may have recovery that you also have to think about. And there's rules on that too. And I know one of the issues potentially with the recovery is that it could actually be in a different period. So then how do you think about all of that interaction?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, is that the rules as they're written are really tied to the relevant fiscal year, and that the disclosure of severe weather events and other natural conditions, if you're required to disclose those capitalized costs or losses, charges, expenses, then it triggers the recovery amount. But if you didn't have those in that fiscal year, you're technically not required to provide disclosure around the recoveries, which is interesting when you think about, you know, if there's like a major event that happened close to the end of the year, then you're recording those costs, if you even incur all those costs at the end, yes, of that relevant fiscal year. But your recovery could be in the next fiscal year. I think we've even talked to some companies, depending on the type of recovery that you're having, that could be, you know, 2 years,
yes,
out, depending on timing. So it's interesting that when you look at what's actually technically triggering the disclosure, you may not trigger that recovery to be disclosed, but I think, again, if a company felt that it was, you know, meaningful to the user of the financial statements, they could voluntarily disclose that. But it is a little bit of an interesting nuance in the rules.
Yeah. And again, maybe from a broader materiality point of view, but this isn't materiality based. So it's definitely is interesting to think through.
I think that maybe just one more point on that, Heather, too, is like there's really no discussion around the recoveries, too, around any sort of de minimis threshold. So technically, if you trigger the 1% threshold to describe, you know, costs or charges, expenses related to a severe weather event or other natural condition, if you had a recovery in the same year, it would trigger that's disclosed kind of regardless of the amount, which is interesting, too.
So, Diana, one follow-up point on that. I know one of the issues or questions that was raised about the proposal and one that PwC raised as well is this idea of, well, are you measuring including things like lost revenue, so something that didn't occur? So what's the final resolution on that?
The quick answer is no, you don't need to include lost revenue. I think the disclosures really focus on amounts that are recorded within the company's books and records. So it would be items that are reflected, you know, in your general ledger. So you don't have to think about things like lost revenue. So I think that at least should make it easier for companies, you know, tracking those items.
Yes, definitely. And again, there's a whole theoretical question about that. So that's a good answer on that. All right, Val, let me bring you in then a few other things on the disclosures. And specifically, I know we have gotten a lot of questions, even from when we wrote PwC's original response to the SEC's proposal about this severe weather events and other natural conditions. So what are some of the key questions you're getting and where would you tell companies to focus?
So it really comes down to trying to figure out what the population of those events are that you need to track. And I think there's a lot of judgment that companies can make. Obviously, we want it to be applied consistently, but the SEC doesn't define those terms. And I think it's first important to remember that it is severe weather and not just the events that are caused by climate change. So it's not about climate. There are areas, obviously, and they also included the other natural conditions, things like earthquakes that could be natural conditions that I guess tenuous. There are some people who think there's a connection between climate change and earthquakes, but it is just about those severe weather events. And we've had discussions with clients about whether there needs to be a declared state of emergency at some, you know, local, state, or federal level. And there really doesn't. So there is judgment, but the idea of there being a declaration of an emergency, there are a lot of factors that go into that about the extent of the damage and the funding or the available funding at the local or state level to respond to it. So I'm not sure that's probably the best basically benchmark or threshold to use, but I think companies can develop their own internal processes on how they want to think about what is severe. And that may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I do think there is a lot of appeal of using some sort of state of emergency or otherwise. So I know it may not be the best way, but it is one potential way companies can.
Companies are definitely looking to come up with some sort of an objective way to measure and take some of the subjectivity out of it.
And I think it goes back to then Diana's points about the fact that you're already not measuring this until after year end. And then if there's all this uncertainty about, is this severe? Is it not severe? Then, you know, I think having some more set methods of how you're going to look at it instead of on a case-by-case basis is appealing to companies.
It is. I think you need to think. To me, you would consider that as maybe one of the factors that you consider in setting what your boundaries are.
Yeah. All right. And Val, the other related question then I know we keep getting is around attribution. So what if something happens that's sort of because of the weather, but sort of because of something else, then how do you think about whether or not it falls into the disclosure?
We think that was one of the positive things in the final rules is that what they talk about, because this was a question during the proposal, is there are so many factors that impact what goes into your financial statements. And what if weather is only one of a bunch of items that affect it? And what they came up with is this idea of attribution or a significant contributing factor. So if what the severe weather event or the natural condition is a significant contributing factor, you would basically include that event in your disclosure and in your calculation of the 1% threshold and all of it. You wouldn't just allocate if you thought weather was a, you know, a 50% contributor. You would take the entire amount in. So that gives a little bit more clarity to the population of things that you do need to consider.
Yes, and we were both just using weather as shorthand for severe weather events and other natural conditions. So to be perfectly clear, the attribution equally applies to these other natural conditions. Yes. All right. Well, definitely, I know there's many, many more questions that you guys have been getting and answering as a group, but I think this is a good stopping point for today. But as at least Val and Kevin know, I always like to wrap up with that final question of what advice would you give? So perhaps, Val, I'll start with you.
I'll take it probably full circle to the idea that there is, this is only one of a bunch of frameworks. So the fact that the SEC rule is stayed, the fact that there's some uncertainty about some of the other disclosures is really just one point to consider. And you really need to make sure that you're looking at the full ESG landscape and all of your requirements.
Excellent. Diana, how about from your perspective?
I think one thing that's interesting here is when we look at like the governance and risk management requirements under this SEC climate rule, we see that this is a trend that we've seen recently from the SEC, that there's a big focus on understanding companies' effective governance oversight by management and the audit committee. And so we've seen that, another rule recently I think of is the cybersecurity rules that came out last year. The disclosures are very similar. So I think this is a trend we're seeing from the SEC. So I think that's important for companies to be focused on.
Yeah, thinking about how this rule fits into the bigger picture actually is the sort of theme of both of you guys, just different, bigger picture. So, all right, Kevin, it's going to be hard to top those two. So yeah, what's your...
save the worst for last. Now, I think, you know, for me, it's, and we've hit on it throughout, right, is starting to do the work and thinking about your systems, thinking about your controls. I think specifically about the financial statements. We talked about being able to track those events. A lot of companies that I've talked to are thinking about, well, let's look back historically at things that have happened over time and basically do a tabletop exercise to figure out how would we think about that? What information do we have available? What are the steps that we need to take? The other thing we talk to a lot of companies about as well is the FASB has their project on disaggregated income statement expenses. That's probably going to require a lot of systems implementation to be able to get that information. Is there some economies of scale to be gained in thinking about both of those things at the same time? But it's really about how do you get yourself ready to be able to report the information? Because you might be scrambling at the end of the year, as Diana pointed out, with that pre-tax income number.
All right. Excellent advice. I like that tabletop exercise idea because that is a good way for companies to get their hands around what the impact may be. So all three of you, as always, very nice to talk to you. Diana, thank you for joining the podcast. I know this is your first time, but welcome on board. And I'm sure we'll be seeing you back if for nothing else than to talk about materiality. So, and then Val and Kevin, thanks as always for being guests. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tune in next week for more fresh episodes. So that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all our latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors, including accountants and lawyers.